This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Kate Tempest. She's a poet, a rapper, performer, musician, playwright, and now novelist. The book we're talking about today, although I hope we'll talk about other things, is called The Bricks That Built the House. How are you, Kate?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
So you've come to America. I mean, you're based in London, yes. As anybody listening will quickly realize. You're British.
Yeah.
So you're here for a book tour?
Yeah. I think we're doing seven different states. Just going around with the book and doing some readings and some Q&As and things.
Right. So, you know, I know of you, or I think a lot of people know of you, primarily as a poet. In America, I'm not sure around the rest of the world, you know, and you've done performances with a band. You know, you're kind of a multimedia artist in a lot of ways. And you've written plays. And I noticed in the back of the book, you mentioned that this novel had its genesis as a play.
Not so much, but the characters from my first play and then from a long poem that I wrote called Brand New Ancients, which was the kind of second theatrical piece that I worked on. The same characters from those plays populate this novel.
Got it.
And so the idea for this universe began when I began to write for theatre, because before that point I'd only ever written rhymes. You know, I hadn't quite got my head around the idea that I could experiment with different forms, or that I could, you know, I could conceive ideas that could merit bigger forms. You know, it was
Like telling a story.
Yeah.
As a play does, or as a novel does.
Yeah.
When did you start writing? Let's go back and sort of think about that.
Just forever, you know.
As a kid?
Yeah, kind of always. There wasn't, people often ask me this, and there's a tendency to kind of want to just, I want so desperately to be able to pinpoint a moment and say, oh, there was this eureka moment, but there kind of wasn't. It's always been a part of my
was
life.
Was it poetry from an early age?
No, I was into stories, really, and the poetry thing, I came quite late to poetry. I was interested in lyrics, in some lyrics and rap lyrics,
right.
And I came to poetry through lyricism. That was my first kind of pull towards it, and I just became obsessed with lyrics, lyricism.
Did you listen to particular songwriters or poets in order to hear the music for yourself, to hear the words in your head, or was it just kind of more, you know, organic than that?
Well, I fell in love with music at a kind of young age and felt very close to musicians, rappers. Felt very close to them. I felt like I had these kind of deep connections with the songs and the albums that I've kind of fell in love with. But the thing that pulled me to music were the lyrics. Even if there's just one rhyme, even if there's hardly any words populating a song, they still spoke to me really, really loudly, clearly. Kind of, it was the first thing I heard in music would be the lyrics. So there was a few rappers that, as soon as I heard them, I was kind of hooked on the kind of dynamics of what they were saying and how they were saying it. But also, yeah, Nina Simone, I was really interested in her lyrics. When I was young, Bob Dylan, just kind of anything that I heard. My dad used to listen to these old kind of 60s rock and roll kind of records, and even these quite simplistic, you know, Baby I Miss You kind of, you know, songs, even that was like, I was interested in how a lyric was put together and how the performance and the delivery of a kind of set of words could completely transform the meaning, you know.
Yeah.
So
do you feel like for you the sound of the words is important? I mean, I noticed in Brand New Ancients there's a line at the beginning that says this book is meant to be performed. While you write, it seems like the experience of the words for you is oral. It's the verbal, the talking, the sounding.
Yeah, I think that all poetry should be spoken. All poetry, even if it's, you know, even if it exists very happily on the page, in the moment that you, the reader, find it, a poem is unfinished until it's read. You know, it's half a thing. But when you read it, when you give it life, in order to really understand the journey this poem is going on, you need to hear it. It's a sung language, you know, it's heightened speech, and it's very musical poetry. It's the whole point of it, you know, it sings.
So, I mean, when you perform, let's say, is your process, you write it and then speak it? I mean, does it change then? Sometimes, you know, when you write something down and then you're in the moment of saying it, you actually change the words.
Yeah, for sure.
Does that happen with when you perform?
Yeah, I think that in terms of kind of editing, your eyes can miss so much. Your eyes become used to seeing a line a certain way, and you just miss. You miss a line that needs to be lost. But as soon as you speak it out loud, your mouth won't pronounce. You cannot bring yourself to speak a line that shouldn't be there. You know, I've found anyway. So
you sort of edit on the fly.
Well, yeah. The minute that I perform a piece, say I've written a poem, it can have a life on the page, and it feels finished. But as soon as I begin to speak it, memorize it, commit it to memory, and feel myself speaking it, just naturally certain bits will change, things will drop from it, you know. And suddenly it finds its kind of true life in this moment where just certain parts of it kind of fall away. You don't need, you know, I think it's a really interesting process, especially committing it to memory.
Right, which you do, yeah. Right, with all of your pieces. I noticed that when I've seen you perform on YouTube.
Yeah.
Which is really hard for a lot of people, you know, the memorization. That's kind of puts you right in the middle of kind of ancient oral tradition, you know, to be able to be a storyteller and do it from memory.
Yeah, I think it's kind of important because in terms of communication, which is what this is, if you're in a room full of people and you're speaking to them, for them, with them, you know, to have a piece of paper or something in between you, a manuscript between you, it feels like it kind of blocks the journey of the exchange, you know. Mm-hmm. Just for me personally, I much prefer to be able to enter into the space where I know the lyric and it's in my body and I don't need to be thinking about it. Because
do you feel like it is part of your body then, that the words and your body are together, you know, that it's a kind of, I use that word again, but organic, you know, it's part of your flesh and bone and blood then?
Once there is a moment when you have memorized it and it begins to not be something that you need to recall, but it is just in, it's just in you. You just need the first line and then you can disappear, you know, it just happens. And that, when that happens, it does feel like it's in my body, yeah. But until that moment, then it's very much a kind of cerebral thing. You can feel yourself looking for it in your brain. But I think that there's an interesting moment with Brand New Ancients, which was kind of 75 minute long poem that I performed with a live score in theatres. And when I was really worried about that particular piece because I'd never memorised anything that long. And the kind of the memorisation of poetry is just really natural because I began in hip hop, where like you would just turn up and you had all your lyrics in your head, and like no rapper would turn up at a gig with their lyrics on a piece of paper. No rapper would do that. Like, it just wasn't part of the culture, you know.
Right.
So that's where it was just always very natural for me that you memorize all your lyrics. You start writing a lyric. By the time you get to the end of it, you know it in your head because you've been. It's part of the process of writing. But with Brand New Ancients, I began to realize that it was kind of unusual to do, and I was a bit worried about it. But then I did this thing where I would throw a ball up and down in the air, and I would speak the lyric out loud and count in my head how many times I was throwing the ball and catching it. And by the time I'd done that, I'd kind of proved to myself that the text was not in my conscious memory. It was now...
Right, because you could do two things at once.
Yeah. So no matter what's happening in the room, no matter if I'm distracted by something, I can trust that actually where the words are coming from is my muscle memory. It's a different memory. It's in somewhere in the back and down in my head rather than at the front, you know?
Yeah.
So once I did that, it was a kind of trick I played on myself to be able to relax and just to trust that it was in there and just... Because the minute you worry about where it is, you lose it, you know? It's like with driving or something something that you just know how to do. The minute you wonder what it is you're doing, you think, well, this can't be right, you know? Right. Right. And suddenly you become discombobulated and you can't quite, you know?
Yeah, no, in fact, an example of that, I don't know whether this will resonate for you, but in baseball, there are players, professional players, great players, and then they'll go through this period where they've forgotten how to throw.
Yeah.
They can't, you know, they just can't, it doesn't work anymore. There's something disconnecting their muscle memory, you know, so that's probably what you're talking about. You know, that it's sort of like if you become too aware of it, you can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
So now, do you have training as an actor, or this is all you did by yourself?
Yeah.
You sort of taught yourself how to do all these things. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it just feels very natural, actually. Because I've spent so much time with music and musicians, it's not really unusual for somebody to have in their repertoire a long, long piece. You know, if you're a piano player, and you have this
stuff.
That's
true.
You know?
I was watching a show the other night. It was about the Philippines, and there are these bar bands there that have to learn millions of songs.
Yeah.
So I asked one guy, this is a little regular bar band, how many songs do you know by heart? And he said, 1,000. I mean, that's a mind-boggling idea that you could memorize 1,000 songs and be able to play them.
But why not? You know, we are as humanity, as human beings, just because we now have the kind of printing press and everything else. But back in the day, the Indian rags, for example, these scales that are like 18 minutes long. These kind of, and that's just one scale.
Aeneid.
Right, goes on for days.
Right. There's so many examples of that. So clearly, human beings have the capacity somewhere, but we've ceded that away to all of our, now it's devices, but it's been all of the technology. You know?
But you know, it's interesting, memory, this is kind of off the point, but memory is a creative, it's stored in the same part of your brain. I learned this the other day. It's next to the kind of creative part of your brain. So memory itself, there've been all these kind of studies done into whether it's a creative act or it's a kind of truthful recollection of the past.
You know, it's creative.
It's so interesting. Yeah. And I think that it's a much bigger and more kind of...
It's like dreams.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, memory and dreams are very closely connected, I think. Yeah. Because dreams are transformations of memory. So there's so much our brains are really amazing. But I think a lot, not everybody exercises their brains the way you are doing. So you got something going on.
Well, thanks. But I think that maybe it's just because of hip hop, I think, at the beginning, and also just, I think rhyme is very pleasing to memorize.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of power.
Like, there's a lot of power to rhyme in terms of it is a way of memorizing.
Yeah.
You know, that I've worked with kids and rhyme, and you can see that it's easier for kids to remember stories that rhyme.
Of course. But I'm sure that you probably have in some bit of your brain somewhere, like a kind of nursery rhyme that you heard once when you were 4 years old or something, that's just in, it's just there, you know? I think it's quite natural for us to remember rhyme. You know, we recall it. So I think it's actually not that much of a... I don't think it's that unusual. I think, but it's just that I kind of fell in love with this particular form and kind of ran at it, you know?
Right. Well, but hip-hop has this power. It's really powerful communication, you know? And I think it's not an accident that hip-hop has become so popular in so many places. I wouldn't have expected, hip-hop to be so popular. Well, maybe I should have, but in all the... You know, and it's kind of...
It's global.
Yeah, everywhere. And it's transformed in each culture that adopts it for itself. Mm. It's a really powerful, interesting, and malleable form. But it's really interesting that it led you to theater, too. And so are you... I haven't seen your plays, so I don't... I mean, I've read the Brand New Ancients, but is that something that you feel is an extension of the poetry writing? You know, gives you a chance to exercise the long form?
Not so much. The plays that I wrote, I've written three, apart from Brand New Ancients, I've written three plays that, they were commissions, that it was work, you know. I got offered this opportunity to to write a play, to conceive a play and write a play for a new writing theatre company in the UK called Pain to Play Out. We kind of specialise in finding new writers, finding new voices and giving them the support to kind of...
So taking people who have not written plays before and giving them the opportunity to
Or people that have written... I think it was quite unusual for them to come to a poet, and at that time I wasn't a published poet, I was publishing myself, but I was a spoken word poet, and I was far away from the kind of publishing establishment or anything like that. I was just a kind of spoken word poet, and James Grieve, who's the director of this theatre company, and they've got a long history of working with some really interesting writers. I think they started in the kind of 60s or the 70s. And I think he felt there was something in my storytelling, which was happening in a 3 or 4 minute poem, that he wanted me to kind of really run at. You know, he wanted me to challenge myself. And he helped me unlock this part of my brain, which was, maintaining narrative, you know, telling story through dialogue, all this kind of stuff, which was difficult and impossible and then achievable. You know, it was a really intense process, but we got through it. But the thing is that for many years, much like other people doing this job, I decided that I wanted this to be my living, you know, not just my passion. I wanted to live for this and from this, you know. So I was teaching, I was taking commissions when I could get them, including for plays and kind of poems for different arts organisations and foundations and charities. I was running around doing gigs, poetry gigs and music gigs. I was selling CDs. You know, it was a very intense and busy time where I was doing everything that I could and taking as much work as I could get. And the plays were kind of a part of that. It's not a form that I was instinctively drawn towards, but I'm actually extremely grateful for the experiences that it gave me. Although I found it really frustrating writing theatre. But then again, it was so rewarding because it's this truly collaborative form. Like, the script is a quarter of a thing, you know. You need the actors, you need the director, you need the set, and you need the audience, you know. Like, and it's not a finished piece until all of those things are working together. That blew me away. That was a really beautiful team to kind of be a part of. But the process itself, I'm not necessarily that moved by a lot of theatre. As part of the commission, I got... the opportunity to go and see some plays. I got given some tickets to go and see some plays. And a lot of what I saw just left me cold, you know. I didn't understand who the plays were for or what they wanted to do in these spaces. And I felt like the audience were not only being ignored, but kind of not even being addressed, like, thematically within these pieces. It just felt like an exercise in cleverness, you know, like... And then I saw a couple of amazing plays and I realised what theatre could do. And it's the kind of form where, for me, it's either mind-blowing and incredible or it feels, you know, completely dismissible and forgettable. But there doesn't seem to be much middle ground for me. It's like I either love it or I cannot be bothered to even sit through it, you know?
Yeah. So how does writing a novel then, how does that come about for you? Because this is really, I mean, writing a novel, this is a big book. It's a long story. And yeah. I was really, when I was reading it, and I love your writing, I think it's really expressive. And there's some things in it that are unusual, the way you write. But I was just thinking about how hard it is to do this when you're doing all these other things. You know, especially if you're touring, and you mentioned in the book, you know, that you wrote this book in part while you were on the road. Mm. That seems to me unimaginable, you know, really hard to do.
Yeah, well, it was pretty full on. My drummer said it was like I had the longest PMT imaginable, so that's the way he put it, which I was actually kind of annoyed about. It was difficult, you know. It was like I wanted to write this story and I've been carrying it around in my brain for 3 years and I've been working towards it in short bursts of time when I could get them between tours, basically, because I've been on tour for 4 years, essentially, either with Everybody Down, which is a record that came out a couple of years ago, or Hold Your Own, which is a book of poems, or Brand New Ancients, which was a touring piece, you know? And there's something kind of exhausting and relentless about the nature of touring, but it's very important for me. Performance is very important. So, yeah, it was a nightmare trying to find the time. And obviously what I wanted was 3 months in a room with a view to kind of sit there and let the muse come to me. But I don't have that luxury, and I needed to write this book. I needed to get it out. And actually, there was something really beautiful about singing about these characters all night at gigs,
yeah.
and then all day sitting in the bus and writing their story. They kind of helped each other grow.
So are these, I was really, the characters, I mean, this is that's the important part of this story. I mean, it's not that there isn't a story, but the characters are really important to the book. And I was really interested in, I kind of, one of the questions I was going to ask you is, are these kind of recognizable figures in your life? You know, I don't mean that they're modeled on individual human beings, but they feel like they represent something, you know, that they are... people that you really care about, you know, they're kind of the a pantheon of like people who are trying to work out their their issues in the modern world.
Well, they're not meant to be symbols for anything bigger than themselves, but inevitably, that is what characters in fiction become. But then they weren't conceived that way, because I think when you're creating characters, you have to completely fall in love with them, for one thing. Like, you have to know them inside out. The things that you have to go through when you're writing a novel, it's ridiculous, right? You have to create this universe. And the second or third draft of this novel was about four times as long. I went through this insane kind of period of them being bigger in my head than my actual life, you know. It was like I couldn't breathe for them breathing in my brain. No, it was really intense. You have to know absolutely everything about absolutely everyone.
And there's a lot of characters in this. I mean,
yes,
it's
well populated.
I was very struck by the difficulty of maintaining them all, you know, that because they're all different.
But the idea is that at any moment in anybody's life, there is the present tense and the kind of smallness of your own life, which feels massive, but actually means nothing without the other lives that surround it. We've kind of become trapped in these very isolated, individualistic ideas about reality and life. But we are nothing without the people around us. And if you keep panning out without the people in the neighboring towns, cities, countries, we're nothing without each other, you know? And this is something that I feel so strongly, and I think literature is biggest teacher of empathy that we have, and I think it's what we need more of in these times. It's more empathy, you know. And the idea is always that at any moment, if you look away from your own life at somebody who's beside you, some stranger on the tube or whatever, you know, their life is as big, as vast, as fraught, as important as you or your loved one's life, you know. But it's just about allowing yourself to adjust the lens so that you can be open to the fact that you're surrounded by huge humanity, you know. And so the idea that every person in this novel is given their space to have a history and a future, you know, and a present,
right.
It can't, maybe it feels a bit exhausting, but what it's meant to do is give an accurate depiction of life in a city, you know, where...
Well, I think you did. And I noticed that you did something always throughout the book, which is notice each of the characters is noticing their surroundings. So every bit of description is scene setting in a certain way, but it's really you're kind of communicating where they are, who they are, and what they're thinking, what they're seeing. I mean, you even kind of did it self-consciously in one place where I think Becky is coming back to London after being gone, and she's in this, I guess it's a cafe or in a bar, I can't remember which, but she's purposely listening to all of what's going on around her. And, you know, we're in New York right now, and I will say I spend a lot of time watching people when I'm in the city. It's really incredible. I mean, I think London is similar, you know, that just the massive humanity and the ability to, you sort of look at people and think, who are they? You know, where were they this morning? You know, what did they do? Where are they going, you know? And then you kind of make up histories for people sometimes, you know? And I think you did that a lot in this. It was really, I like that. I mean, you certainly captured London. It's set in Southeast London. I think for most Americans, you know, we don't know the details. It's kind of it's really part of you. So it, you know, there are things in there you probably take for granted that I think British readers may get that are a little more challenging, let's say. But you're really expressive, you know, the language and the dialogue, the description is all really local in that way. You know, it's really, in that way, I think really powerful. I liked a lot about that. I mean, I like the story too. It's, I don't want to talk about too much about the story, but I liked the circularity and connectiveness, which unfolds. Yeah. So you don't really know what's going on. It takes a while to figure out where you are, to kind of get your bearings in the book. And I liked that, you know, that I was kind of entering a world. I didn't know what the scope of the world was. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the story is, really. I mean, it becomes clear later in the book. Mm-hmm. So I like the way you did that. And it's unusual, I think, mm-hmm. the way you structured the book.
Yep. Thanks for saying such nice things about it. Yeah, I mean, the challenge of it was because the plot already exists in this record that I made. The two things were conceived together, the album and the novel.
That's funny because I've listened to the album and I didn't make that connection.
Oh, there you go. Well, the story is essentially the same, and chapter by chapter, each chapter corresponds with each track. The chapters in the book relate maybe in a kind of abstract way to some of the themes within the songs, even if they are not the narrative-driven songs, because within the record there are three songs that step outside of the narrative. God, it's so exhausting to talk about it. But it's like, in my brain, in the moment,
it all makes sense.
It all makes perfect sense. But so the kind of idea of the plot, although it's very important in the kind of climactic moments when it all comes together, the feeling of these kind of threads hanging loose and you just kind of going through this universe. I wanted the novel to feel like that because the album is kind of so sharply driven by narrative all the way through. But you know, if I can tell a story in a 48-minute 12-track record, why do I need a 399-page novel? Well, because I want to go deeper into the kind of tissue of each person and into the tissue of the city, you know. So this kind of expansive and kind of, I don't know, kind of exploded way of telling a story, it's meant to be the kind of flip side of this very sharply driven, you know, electronic hip hop record that came out. So confusing, isn't it?
No, I don't think it's not confusing, but I think it takes a bit of imagination to grasp.
Yep.
And one other thing I wanted to ask you about this: every character, you're very careful to give their lineage, sort of. You know, you talk about their parents and their family, and it feels like that matters a lot to you. Mm. You know, that each person is not just a person; they're the kind of culmination of all these other beings that have preceded them, and of course, many of these your characters have non-traditional family upbringings. You know, they don't have, most of them are not a traditional mother and father. So is that kind of, I mean, was that, did you do that on purpose?
Yeah, there was a question that I have been asking myself for a long time, which is, you know, at what point does a person begin to become the person that they are? At what point does it begin? Is it in you, or is it in your parents, or is it in your grandparents? And I'm very interested in mythology, as you probably know, because of Brand Ancients and everything else. So
I think a lot of William Blake.
I think a lot of poets feel very connected to mythology. It's a beautiful kind of archetypal way of understanding humanity. But in mythology, there was always, as I was reading it as a kid, there was this kind of, usually patrilineage, but from the father to the son, you know, usually. Yeah. And what happens now, so there's a character in the book who doesn't know who his dad is. He never met him, but we know the story of who his father is. And actually, turns out he was a great man, you know, he did some really amazing things. But Leon, my character, he's carrying this kind of the magnitude of his lineage, but he is unaware of where he began. So in a sense, he is everything he's ever been.
Well, and Becky also. Very, you know, she's still, it's unresolved.
Yep.
Totally unresolved. Maybe you have to write more about her because she does need to deal with it.
Yeah, she's going through it.
She's never going to figure that out.
But I've been interested for a long time about these kind of things, and it just feels like another step in my work towards making sense of some things that I've been turning around in my brain for quite a long time. I don't know.
Well, it'll be really interesting to see what people, you know, how people respond and how, yeah, you know, how they get this in, you know, I mean, because it's interesting, you know, you have an audience, you know, people who know your work as a musician, as a poet. Often for them it will be a leap to read a novel of this, you know, the depth and the length of the novel, maybe, you know, I'm not saying that it will be challenging, but it's just that a lot of people who listen to music may not immediately have thought of you as a novelist.
I think there's something quite exciting to be said for introducing somebody who maybe isn't reading all the time to the kind of how pleasurable it is to get lost in a novel. You know, somebody knows my work because of a record I made, or because of a poem that they saw on YouTube or whatever, and if they decide to sit down with a book and read it, that's so exciting for me, because I think reading fiction for me is such an important part of life. And similarly, if somebody who's a kind of avid reader picks up the book and hears about the book from whatever, because they you know, they read whatever Bloomsbury put out, you know, whatever, you know, so if they then decide to kind of backtrack and investigate this kind of underground UK hip-hop record that came out on this strange record label coming out of Brixton, you know, that's that's cool for me. I quite like the idea of the two worlds colliding.
Yeah, well, they do. I think the world of fiction and the world, I mean, there is, I'm sure there are plenty of people like me who read and who listen to music and, you know, do both. But, you know, and also I think there are people who don't read poetry.
Yeah.
You know, that you probably have, and I think this is really important too, that you've reached people who may not have ever read a poem before.
Yeah, and some people are up in arms about that.
But, oh, you mean like traditional poets?
Yeah, I think so, but that's okay.
No, I think poetry needs to be as expansive as possible, so does fiction.
But the thing is, it's interesting because that there are, you know, we were talking before we started recording about about your kind of poetry space that you have that's been running for 50 years. You know, that it's not a new thing to gather and listen to poets speak.
That's right.
It's not a new thing at all. It's an ancient thing, actually. And with every generation, I think it's rediscovered. I think that somewhere along the line, we forgot, as artists, we've forgotten that our role in the community is in the community, rather than being these kind of elevated, separate beings who make work to exist in this kind of vacuum of intellectualism. Or actually, it's much more important, satisfactory, and natural that the artists exist within their communities and speak of the things that affect them in their community. You know, so poets, we exist at this particular frequency. We're tuned in to life at this particular frequency, which makes us kind of hypersensitive. We feel things at a particular register that makes us want to, you know, sing experience, right? So we have a duty then to the people that are too busy or blocked, but still have these feelings going on, but don't quite have the language to articulate it, or the time, or the, you know, the tendency. And that what a poet can do for a person who needs to go there in themselves but doesn't have the capacity to do it, it's very important. You know, it's a kind of, it's a mutual thing. You know, it should be for people, not just for.
Right. Well, that's a different. I think that what you're proposing is in opposition to the notion of art as on a pedestal, to be valued as kind of a heightened experience that only the few can understand. And that doesn't mean that art isn't expressive and creative, because it is, no matter what. But what you're talking about is kind of, replacing poetry and art into the social fabric.
Yeah.
You know, don't see it as outside of normal daily life. It's not kind of super special, that it needs to be protected in some way.
I mean, it is super special. It's a beautiful and important part of life, but it doesn't exist outside of the community that it begins in, you know?
Yeah.
I think that the kind of ivory tower thing that happens. I understand it. Like, the academics have protected language, and they're so important because they're the reason that certain texts have lasted. It's the reason that we have. It's the reason that I know about mythology at all, is because the academics preserved it and they kept it and they studied it and they brought it to life. I just think that somewhere along the way, poetry especially has, I think it's forgotten that it's for people. I think in the moment of it being written is a different thing. The writing and the creating and the recording of music and of art, that is something between the artist and the work itself. But in the moment of performance, in the moment the work is finished, it needs to be communicating. It needs to be for people. And this is what I was saying at the beginning about a poem being unfinished until it's read. You know, this. There is another part of the poet's journey towards writing a poem, which is about the person who reads it. You know, I don't think that all art should be kind of pandering to the masses or anything like that. I just think that we need to kind of, renegotiate the role of the artist again, because it's damaging to raise people up too high. It's damaging and restrictive. It's actually much more useful to serve a role within your community. That's, you know, I keep repeating myself.
But that's, I think, why a lot of people feel like Bob Dylan is one of the great poets.
Yeah.
And then other people say, no, he can't be a poet. He's just a songwriter. But he really is a great, great communicator.
You know?
And he existed, you know, as an expression of a time, and acting, as you said, I think that's a role of the poet, the artist, is to capture the news before anybody else hears it.
Yeah.
And to say it back.
In other cultures and in other times, that was the role, you know.
Yeah.
I was in Mexico to do some gigs, and I was really blown away by how public art is. It's everywhere, you know. It's a part of people's lives. It's no big deal that somebody who's kind of not got much in their lives can have a real reaction to a piece of sculpture. It's like, of course.
Right.
It really shocked me back to feeling, you know, being like, of course, it's as if people who are not educated or who are not wealthy cannot get a kick out of art. It's a disgusting view that actually, it's populated by people that want to control beauty.
I think that's kind of part of the capitalist system, is to create hierarchical meaning, and that, you know, it reflects the social structure.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's...
I went completely off topic, but I've been enjoying talking about it.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you could read a little bit of The Bricks That Built the Houses.
Sure.
There's a lot here that I could suggest reading, but we talked about earlier, maybe just read the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a really nice opening, and plus, later you would need more context.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can read as much as you feel comfortable doing.
Well, I'll just read the first couple of pages, but I should probably say that the book begins in this kind of poetic voice, which is meant to act as a bit of a bridge between my previous work as a poet, and then we kind of move into the more kind of narrative-driven prose voice. But so just to let people know that the whole novel isn't in this register. It's not like...
No, it's true. It is a very lyrical opening to the book. And then it kind of sets you up for storytelling.
Yeah, but I'll just do the lyrical bit, I think. So, it gets into your bones. You don't even realize it until you're driving through it, watching all the things you've always known and leaving them behind. They're driving past the streets, the shops, the corners where they made themselves, and every ghost is out there staring, bad skin and sunken eyes, grinning madly at them from the past. It's in their bones, bread and booze and concrete. The beauty of it, all the tiny moments blazing. Preachers, parents, workers, empty-eyed romantics going nowhere. Streetlights and traffic and bodies to bury and babies to make a job. Just a job. People are killing for gods again. Money is killing us all. They live under a loneliness so total it has become the fabric of their friendships. Their days are spent staring at things. They trust nothing but trends. The most that they can hope for is a night out smashed to pieces, sloppy face from booze and drugs that hate them in the morning, but here they are, leaving. Leaving the stress and shit food and endless misunderstandings, leaving. The job centre, the classroom, the pub, the gym, the car park, the flat, the filth, the TV, the constant swiping of news feeds. The Hoover, the toothbrush, the laptop bag, the expensive hair product that makes them feel better inside. The queue for the cash machine, the cinema, the bowling alley, the phone shop, the guilt, the absolute nothingness that never stops chasing. The pain of seeing a person grow into a shadow. The people's faces twisting into grimaces again, losing all their insides in the gutters, clutching lovers till the breath is faint and love is dead. Wet cement and spray paint, the kids are watching porn and drinking Monster. Now watch the city fall and rise again through mist and bleeding hands. Keep holding on to power ballad karaoke hits, chase your talent, corner it, lock it in a cage, give the key to someone rich and tell yourself you're staying brave. Tip your chair back, stare into the eyes of someone hateful that you'll take home anyway, and tell the world you're staying faithful. Nothing's for you, but it's all for sale. Now give until your strength is frail, and when it's at its weakest, burden it with hurt and secrets. It's all around us, screaming paradise, until there's nothing left to feel. Suck it up. Gob it, double drop it, pin it deep into your veins, now try forever to get off it. Then close your eyes and stop it. But it never stops.
That's beautiful.
On it goes.
I don't know, it's like, well, you know, hearing you read that, I think maybe you should read the whole book. Not now. But no, it's really, it transforms the language. It really does.
I wanted to do an event, you know, like over five nights, reading for 2 hours a night. People can come and listen to all of it or one of the nights. You know, it's what they used to do. They used to tell stories over a few days.
Yeah. I think it would be like you're like a festival, you know. Yeah. You could do it almost like, you could do it as a retreat, you know. You go somewhere, charge a lot of money, people have to put them up in a hotel.
It's gotta be free, it's gotta be public. I don't know, it's just an idea at the moment.
No, it's a great idea.
Awesome.
Well, thank you for doing that. That was really
amazing.
So, thank you so much for talking to me. I know you have lots of places to go and people to talk to, but I really appreciate it.
So, thank you.
Thanks. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors, and I've been talking to Kate Tempest about her new novel, The Bricks That Built the Houses. It's a beautiful book, as you now can tell, and I really, really recommend it. Thanks.